Whoa. I guess it shows up as a okay. Kathleen, can you hear me okay? Great. So we could call what we're doing today, making peace with pleasure and pain, if that's possible. And I like to say that 2,500 years ago, the Buddha sat down under a tree and solved your problem. And he solved my problem, and he solved his problem. And he solved the problem that any sentient being will have for the rest of time. He solved the most fundamental problem of being sentient. And there's lots of problems with being sentient, but this is the linchpin. And it's really simple. The Buddha made it so simple. We only know how to be happy if we're having a pleasant experience. That's your basic problem. If you're suffering in life, that's why. There's 1,000 other reasons you're suffering. We all do. But that's what's the most fundamental issue. We don't know how to be okay and open when it's unpleasant. And we don't even know neutral exists. Neutral is like death, right? Like, look at the wall, you know? Whoever really looks at a wall, we would, pleasant is definitely top of the list. But we'll take unpleasant any day over neutral. You know, Tabasco, we'll take that, even if we have to drink it, over just some like humdrum, bland oatmeal, you know, on the plate. And, you know, or just to notice anything neutral anywhere, we never do. And our nervous system is wired for this. Because what's neutral, probably evolutionarily, had no survival value for us. Pleasant? Absolutely. You know, that has survival value, and unpleasant also. We want to stay away from the things that threaten us and go towards the things that benefit us. So our nervous system is wired this way. But lo and behold, no scientist could ever explain this. How did evolution shape us so that's the basic wiring of any sentient being? We have greed for the pleasant, aversion to the unpleasant, and we ignore the neutral, right? That's called being sentient. That's our basic physical wiring. It's not personal, it has nothing to do with you. It's who you are because you got born into a sentient body. But somehow evolution designed us to be able to be bigger than that. And the entire Buddhist path is about how we can be okay when it's unpleasant or when it's neutral, and how to not grab when it's pleasant. So that's what practice is all about. Now, you know, that's the wisdom side of practice. The love side of practice, it's also about that too, that we can learn to love more and more and more, because our ability to love is primarily a function of our mental habits. If you think of yourself as loving or not loving, that isn't personal. That's actually training. With what you do day in, day out in your mind. We train ourselves to be more judgmental, more angry, you know, more divisive, or more loving, more open, more compassionate. That's training. And so that, you know, that bumper sticker, choose love, right? It's a beautiful metta bumper sticker, right? So we're always practicing and we can choose love. So that's the other side of practice. So we're really, you know, speaking today with the mindfulness side. So if we're just on the mindfulness side, and by the way, those two are completely just flip sides of the same coin, wisdom and love, ultimately, are the same thing. So the wiser we become, the more loving we become. We can't become more loving without becoming more wise, because only, you know, by through wisdom can we go past our preferences and love even people we don't like. So on this wisdom side of the practice, this is what we're doing. We're learning how to make peace with pleasure and pain. And we all share this. Every one of us in this room, no matter what you're going through, this is the crux issue. Can you be okay when it's pleasant? Can you be okay when it's neutral? I meant to say unpleasant. Thank you. Thank you. That's a very important part of it. Yeah, otherwise that just made no sense. Phew.
Could you repeat it again for those of us who are confused now?
I'm not sure. That was so long ago. Okay. On the wisdom side of practice, what we're learning to do is to be open-hearted and okay when it's pleasant, when it's unpleasant, and when it's neutral. We know how to do the pleasant more or less until we start grabbing. As long as the pleasant's here, we're pretty good at being open, right? But if the pleasant starts to leave, that's when all the trouble starts. That's when we start to grab. Because guess what? If the pleasant leaves, the unpleasant or the neutral is about to arrive. So we really are learning to be open-hearted with all three, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So I find it really interesting, it's obviously, this is clearly, you know, the crux of things, but I find it very interesting in the Buddha's mindfulness instructions, there's like, you know, thousands of pages of the Buddha giving lots of advice on how to behave, you know, how to not cause harm with speech, not cause harm with actions. Surprisingly little instruction on mindfulness, how to actually meditate, which is a little odd because the tradition is so much about practice. But the main sutta, there's two main suttas, the breath sutta, Anapanasati, thank you, mind, sutta, and the Satipatthana sutta. So there's a whole sutta on how to be aware of the breath, like 16 different ways. And then is the Satipatthana sutta, is the four foundations of mindfulness. And does anyone know the four foundations, like the basic divisions? Like if you're going to be mindful, these are the four basic arenas we need to apply our mindfulness to. So the most basic divisions for the Buddha, he set up mindfulness of body, mindfulness of mind. Wow, okay. That's kind of covers it all, right? The physical and the mental. And when he's talking about mindfulness of body, he's also talking about the physical world outside of us, not just our body, but the entire physical world. And when he's talking about mindfulness of mind, he's talking about our entire mental world, thoughts, emotions, memories, intentions, etc. But there's two more foundations. The other foundation is to be aware of the core Buddhist teachings and be aware of them in your experience. So the five hindrances, the six sense bases, the five aggregates, four noble truths, etc. A bunch of numbers. And so the Buddha felt it was very important to really pay attention to those structures in our experience. It seems like that would sort of cover it all, the physical world, the mental world, and then the Buddhist teachings, how they might actually manifest. But there's a fourth, and maybe you'll guess it. What might you guess the fourth to be?
The pleasant, unpleasant, neutral thing.
Yes, the pleasant, the pleasant, neutral thing. Yes, feeling tone. And speech is very important. And let's see. It's in the Four Noble Truths, speech is in there, actually, in the fourth truth, which is the Eightfold Path. And in the Eightfold Path is a lot about wise speech. So that just got thrown into the mindfulness. It's called mindfulness of dhammas, right? So that's that being aware of the mindfulness teachings, dharma teachings. Okay, so body, mind, dharma teachings, and then all those are specific targets, but feeling tone is an instruction, and that's everywhere. That's just the atmosphere. So he singled that out as pay attention to this. When you're being aware of body, when you're being aware of mind, when you're being aware of the Dharma teachings, notice feeling tone. That's how important this is. It's its own separate thing. The others are content, but this is process. You're just noticing the process of things, like the tone of things. And this is so important because it's actually not feeling tone that causes dukkha, right? So we know the first noble truth of dukkha, and the cause of dukkha is craving. And craving is the Buddha's term for our reactivity. Craving meaning we want things to be different than they are. And our reactivity is as simple as this: greed for the pleasant, aversion to the unpleasant, and delusion or ignorance of the neutral. When you look at your reactive places, it's going to be one of those three. And isn't it amazing? Like the Buddha boiled this down to be very simple. Like, you know, the guy was wise because he could make it so simple. Like, does anyone disagree with this basic construct? I mean, I'd love to hear it. I can't find a way to disagree with it, but. Would you all agree that this is the crux of the issue? We don't know how to be okay when it's unpleasant or neutral, or when the pleasure starts waning. Well, you might have a way you disagree that, yeah, I mean, no. Okay. So, now, notice he didn't say the second noble truth is not the cause of your suffering of dukkha is feeling tone. That is not the second noble truth. The second noble truth is the cause of dukkha is craving, which is your relationship with feeling tone. How are you relating to feeling tone? Greed, aversion, delusion. There is an alternative. That's what's so amazing. We can have a non-reactive relationship with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And we've been practicing it. You know, if you've noticed once in your life an unpleasant experience, let's say an itch in your shoulder, and instead of scratching it, you chose to be mindful of it, and you just noticed it's unpleasant. And then your mind was focused on it. And when the mind focuses, we actually relax. And we actually start subtly becoming okay. And then maybe the itch leaves all by itself. We never even had to scratch it. That is a little micro mini moment of what the Buddha meant by freedom. You don't have to scratch the itch for the itch to go away. Instead, you scratch it with mindfulness. You just notice what it's like. And then weirdly, that backs us into sort of being okay. And the stronger our mindfulness becomes, the more okay we are, as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral does its dance. So this very simple practice that we're doing, which is now sort of everywhere, right? You can find mindful everything now. Mindful poker. I always thought that was very funny. There's a mindful approach to poker. It's everywhere. And it's very ordinary. What's the big deal? You know, when drinking a glass of water, just drink the water. Feel the glass. What's the big deal? What's the big deal? Just feel your breath. Big whoop. You know, there's lots of not big deal, ordinary things we do that do not lead to full awakening, right? Checking a text, big deal, someone texted me and I texted back, okay, big deal. That doesn't lead to awakening. This is the very ordinary, not big deal thing we do that leads to full awakening, because it solves this conundrum of our nervous system, which is being okay with the play of pleasure and pain. That's like the whole Dharma path. So this very ordinary practice is deeply profound. It's not just for stress reduction, as good as that is. It's great. We want all of that, right? And it's a lot more. So, this is very important. Feeling tone doesn't cause our suffering. Our relationship with it does. If we're in reaction, if we don't know anything about mindfulness or love, we're miserable. If we can wake up to it and see how it is, then over time and with training, we learn to become more and more equanimous. We're more and more okay as pleasure and pain does its dance. And it doesn't matter who you are and how rich, how famous, how successful, how young, how gorgeous, how talented, you know, how athletic you are, it doesn't matter from this perspective. Your life is still going to be one moment after another of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There's no getting out of it. You cannot succeed your way out of feeling tone. All success will still, the day of the most famous, successful person in life will still be a day of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Here's an example. This was back in NPR about 10 years ago. And a music producer, Joe Smith, interviewed some of the musicians that he produced in the mid 80s. And he published a book about it, Off the Record. And he produced many, many famous musicians: Jerry Garcia, Ella Fitzgerald, David Bowie, Ray Charles, George Harrison. I mean, imagine, you know. And so he interviewed musicians and eventually published a book about it. So he asked George Harrison, how hard is it to be George Harrison? And George said, it's getting easier all the time. It was very difficult once we got into the heavy period of the Beatles in the early 60s and through the mania, the Beatlemania. That was very difficult. Then we went through the drug period, which scrambled our brains up. And then after the Beatles split, historically, we all know there was all the legal problems. But I'm glad to say I've come out of the other end of the tunnel and that I feel really, really good about it. And I'm a happy person. You know, this is like 15 years after the Beatles. And he asked George Harrison about his, you know, most famous song, Something. And he told the interviewer, Joe Smith, how much he loved James Brown's version of that song, Something. And he sent James Brown a postcard telling him, like, wow, you really did a great job with that song. So the story was on NPR. NPR was interviewing Joe Smith, the guy that interviewed all the musicians. And so the NPR reporter asked, so to Joe, when you finished doing the interviews over those 2 years, did you find you came away from it with any kind of conclusions about what qualities a lot of these artists shared? Ray Charles, Ella Fitzgerald, Jerry Garcia, George Harrison. Cool, like, what do they all have in common? Cool. This is going to be a key to the universe, right? Okay, Joe Smith said, I felt that if there was one emotion that went through the old ones and the new ones, it was insecurity. The next record, is that going to be a hit? Are they going to continue to be stars and be idolized? Because everybody has the moment when their records were on the charts, the moment when the crowds were at their concert, and then the moment passes. But they remain big and important, but they're not the moment anymore. And that bothers them. I remember reading Andre Agassi's biography, Open, all about tennis and, you know, his tennis career. And somewhere in there he said, rich and famous people are so boring. They're just like anyone else, so duh, of course, we all know that. Even the Buddha did not transcend feeling tone. He died of food poisoning. And the story goes that he was offered a meal and he was 80 years old and by someone named Kunda, and he knew the meal was tainted, was like bad, had gone bad. But the food was offered to him, and you always just need to eat whatever anyone offers to you. That's the Buddhist tradition. And the Buddha also said, well, my karma has ripened. And so he ate it knowing it would kill him, and he died. How do you think dying of food poisoning, you know, was on the feeling tone level? Probably intensely unpleasant. But the Buddha died in peace because he was the Buddha. His mind had fully, like, accessed that wisdom of, I don't need unpleasant to be any different than it is, because it doesn't actually equate with my well-being. His well-being had really transcended pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, even while he was deeply experiencing it. And so that's the awakened mind. It's not on some enlightened cloud somewhere away from our experience. It's right in it, right in the middle of it. And where else would we want our enlightenment to be, right? It's not on some puffy cloud somewhere that's out of this world. It's right here in this world exactly as it is. So in this series on hope and fear, So let's see. If, yeah, hope and fear is just, you know, a flavor of greed, aversion, delusion, right? Hope is a kind of greed for the pleasant, and fear is a type of aversion to the unpleasant. So if that's the cause of suffering, it's very easy. The third noble truth of Nibbana is not saying, so just stop your greed, your aversion, and your delusion. Just stop it. That isn't the third noble truth. You know, the path and the third noble truth is saying there is Nibbana. So really it's the fourth noble truth I'm talking about. And the fourth noble truth is the path towards Nibbana or Nirvana. And that's basically the path of mindfulness and everything that supports mindfulness. That is the path. The path is not trying to get rid of hope and fear. We haven't been doing that at all, right? What have we been doing instead of trying to get rid of it? Hope and fear. What have we been doing instead? I haven't been teaching, you know, get rid of hope and fear. Yeah. Notice it. Be mindful of it. The minute, and this is the path is so forgiving. We can be mindful of any moment. We can wake up in a chain of 50 links of reaction. And the minute we wake up to one of those moments, we're out of reaction. So this is not about trying to not have hope and fear. This is about instead waking up to them and knowing they're here. And then we naturally let go. Our system is built to let go. If we're clear, we do let go of that which afflicts us. We do, you know, this system is naturally geared when there's mindfulness to let go of that wiring of greed, aversion, delusion. We're naturally wired to let go of that wiring, which is so cool. We just need to start becoming very mindful of how it's working for us. And we see, oh, yeah, the pleasant is nice, but when I try to grab, the grabbing itself is unpleasant. Oh. So then how do I relate to the pleasant? William Blake said it best, kiss the joy as it flies. That is how. When something pleasant happens, we kiss it, we appreciate it, and we enjoy it. That is not actually greed. That is the simple, natural enjoyment of our nervous system. Like Mary Oliver said it well, let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. That's just simple enjoyment while it's here. If it starts to fly and we try to like grab the bird or put it in a cage, that's when the trouble starts. So instead, we kiss the joy as it flies, but do you hear the wisdom in it? The pleasure itself is flowing. So anything pleasing to you, if we're aware of it mindfully, we see that it's flow. And my favorite way to see that is eating. And I'm like, cool, lunch. I mean, the three L's, whatever. The fourth L, that's the L I like. I like lunch. So here we go. Cool. Oh, dang it. When he said, like, you know, put the hand down and like, so I can focus on my food. Okay, fine. I'm on retreat. So, okay, I'll do it. You know. And then what do you notice? It's nice. Ah, you know, cheese enchilada with lettuce, shredded lettuce and onion and tomato and cilantro with some lime, fresh lime juice. Man, that's the mind. But what was the experience in my mouth? Just flow, 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 swallow. Oh, now some more, I need some more. Okay, flow, 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 swallow. That joy was there and I was very much like enjoying it. But it was flowing the whole time. And we have our conceptual mind is like, oh, I'm gonna have lunch and it's gonna be this thing, you know, like a bowling ball. It's this thing and it's gonna give me pleasure. Right? It's some solid, stable thing. But that's not the experience. The experience is just flow. So, what's really cool, and you might have noticed this, when we are mindful of pleasant, two things happen that are really helpful. The first is we're going to actually enjoy it more because we show up for it. So a lot of times I'll just, you know, like my lunch is like a shovel ready project and I'm just boom, 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 get it done. Oh, finally, I just stop. And I'm going to enjoy that a lot more than normal. So, and then an odd thing happens. You're going to enjoy it more, but be less attached. Because when you are mindful of it, and slow down with it and actually have the pleasant experience, then you see its flow. And you realize you can't grab flow. That would be like trying to grab a river or a waterfall. You can't. It's just flow. So the more you're mindful with pleasure, you're going to win twice. You're going to win by enjoying it more, and then you're going to win by not having greed, because you're going to see it's just flow. I can kiss it, but I can't grab it. So, so this is how to not suffer with pleasure, because we do. We suffer with it because we're attached to it. When we see it as flow, then we don't. So we're kind of in this phase moment of the talk where this is really so much about being kind to our experience. Do you hear the kindness in the mindful path? Oh, I get the problem is greed, aversion, delusion, but I'm not trying to get rid of it. I'm trying to wake up to it. There's so much kindness in that. And then as we get sort of like bigger than our experience, as we start to be more mindful and get bigger than it, then we can start to have a sense of humor. And then we can watch ourselves. I mean, I'm a 6 on the Enneagram, if you know the Enneagram, with a 7 wing. And the 7 wing is, you know, the sort of sub type there's a lot of that too. And the 7 types are pleasure hogs. You know, they just go for the pleasure. And I can watch myself do that. And I can have a sense of humor about it. There I go. That's my 7th thing. No. So we can just like, we can relax. And we can just, you know, take ourselves lightly. And Rita Rudner says she loves to go shopping after a relationship. You know, talk about pleasure seeking. It really helps her recover to just go shopping. And so she said, sometimes when I see a really nice outfit, I break up with someone on purpose. And we can poke fun at ourselves for our device use. We can have a sense of humor. Has the pandemic made you more of an internet addict than you used to be? Definitely for me. And I was up one night, like all night, surfing the internet. I mean, hundreds of sites trying to figure out if I was an internet addict. And I finally got to a site that had a test. Are you an internet addict? And it just had one question. The question was, are you reading this? So, and you know, the technology is affecting us so much. You can see all this humor now about our brains getting technologized. A t-shirt, my mind is like my browser. 19 tabs are open, 4 of them won't load. And where's this music coming from? Meditation instructions, in your mind's browser, clear your cache. Now delete your history. Now navigate to a blank page. Cartoon of a brain surgeon who's hovering over a patient with all the surgical aids around. We have to relieve the pressure on his skull. So I'm going to go in and remove about 24 passwords. So, okay, so that's the mindlessness. That's our mindlessness practice. But we have mindfulness practice. Oh, good, we know what to do. And it's everywhere. Now, as I said, mindful poker. You know, mindful poker, don't you sort of get the humor in that? A little bit of a clash of cultures, don't you think? Okay, you know, invite the scotch to come in the mouth and feel the way the whole torso warms. You know, lift the cigar and slowly savor the smoke. You know, roll the table. And then I think it's funny too, because really, you could think we'd be pretty good at the poker face, you know, in poker. Because like, you know, this is a person on retreat just freaking out that like their home is going to get foreclosed on. And then here's the meditator falling wildly in love. And here's a meditator who's just had their heart broken. We're pretty good at the poker face. I think the last technological thing to poke fun of is this whole thing about mindfulness on our phones. And something about that seems like just, right? It's our weapon of mass distraction. So I might as well, maybe, the thing that makes me so mindless, wouldn't it be cool if there was an app in there for mindfulness? And there are. There's lots of mindfulness apps. But I do think it's a little bit funny, just mindfulness in your phone, right? I mean, this is the culture of the phone, right? Is like, we don't even have time in a text trail to type OK. We only have time for K, right? I mean, that's the phone culture. And in the phone, the culture of the phone is like, I want like the universe handed to me yesterday, you know? It's just like this device of instant gratification. And so you're gonna do your 45 minute sit on your phone, but you're gonna do your best to nail it in 10. So this is our life. It is what it is. And we can have a sense of humor. Okay, so just a little more about practically working on this, and then let's talk a little bit, you know, about practice, see if there's questions. So a little bit about how to work with pleasant, we've already gone into. Very important, how do we work with unpleasant, right? And the instruction I'm gonna, you know, suggest is gonna apply to about like 1 through 6 or 7 on the scale. 8, 9, and 10, like my advice would be just like fasten your seatbelt and hang on for dear life. Because when pain is super, super extreme, it's just survival. And one of my Dharma teacher friends, you know, had hip surgery, and after 30 years of practice, it just, the surgery somehow was botched and they had to redo it. And the pain was so intense for her. And she got through it, you know. But I asked her, so, you know, when the pain was that intense, was it like, could you practice at all? She's like, no way. It was just too much. So let's talk about kind of the 1 through 7 end of the scale. I mean, excruciating pain is absolutely workable in mindfulness when you have tremendous amount of mindfulness, right? So that's possible. So not to discount it. And it can be, you know, in the Monday night group, there's a midwife in the group, and she says, actually pain, that level of pain, mindfulness is very helpful, even when it is like that bad, like 8, 9, or 10. So not to say it can't be used then, but you know, childbirth is different. There's a whole different meaning with that kind of pain, right? But the basic frame for working with unpleasant, we already know from doing the RATA, you know, recognize, accept, turn towards, and turn away. We can do the same thing with physical pain. And everything you've been doing already with sensation, you know, you find where it is, and then you get curious about it just as it is. Now, turning towards really has a powerful psychological effect, because we are normally in total resistance mentally to the physical pain. When we turn towards it, what we do is we take away the mental resistance. And mental resistance often shows up as tension in the body. And so pain can ease some. I'm not saying all of it is, you know, when there's physical pain, it's not all just mental. But, you know, some pain can lessen just by that attitude of being willing to feel it. I see, this is a tiny little example. On my bathroom floor, the heat is always down at night, the house is cold, and we have a tile bathroom floor, and the floor is cold. And I notice, like, I try to scurry across it, and that's the resistance. But if I sometimes, when I'm mindful, I just slow down and just feel it, it's like, oh, it's just cold. It's not like a catastrophe. It's just cold. And I can feel it. It's not nearly as bad in my mind as it is in my body. And so that's a really powerful lesson about turning towards pain. If it's an 8 in your mind, what you might notice sometimes, a 1 or 2 or a 3 in the body can be in 7 or 8 or 9 in the mind. We are not very good with being uncomfortable. So turning towards and being willing just to feel the experience just as it is can actually really reduce our suffering. And I've had chronic pain in my knee. I had 2 years of just kind of relentless, but off and on pain in my knee. And I couldn't walk for 1.5 years. And I had to work with that all the time. Just feel it. You have all your stories about it and all of that, but that's where all the dukkha lives, is in the story. The knee pain itself is like 2 or 3 or 4. I wouldn't often overdo it, but sometimes I wouldn't. It would be worse. But what was 2 or 3 or 4 in the knee was terrible in my mind. And for me, partly it was just adjusting to, oh, I've never had a really like disability. For about 1.5 years, I was disabled. So the suffering was mental, mostly. So this turn towards has a lot of relief in it. And then turn away is also important. We also want to notice what isn't uncomfortable or painful in the body. Because if I say, I'm in pain, that language itself is escalating the situation. If I said there's pain in my knee, that's going to track my experience, pain in my left knee. If I say I'm in pain, that doesn't track my experience. My experience would be if I turn away, just like we did with, you know, hope and fear, if I turn away from the pain, I can see right knee's fine. The whole right side is fine. The whole upper body's fine. My left thigh is fine. Even my calf and my foot are fine. About 5% of me is in pain. That's the true story. I'm in pain escalates. So the turning away is really helpful when working with pain. It's very draining if you only focus on pain. So you can keep coming back to something unpleasant, but definitely go away to the other parts of you that are not unpleasant. And then you're going to have a much more true view, because our mind gets so freaked out by unpleasant that we just grab it. The thing we most don't want is what we then become obsessive about. It's so weird. So we need to actually pry our attention away sometimes from the pain and be willing to feel everything in the body that's fine. Okay, so that's unpleasant. And then last, neutral. Okay, how to work with neutral. This is important. Let's try something together. If you would, we're gonna come into a little mindfulness just for a minute or so. If you would relax and soften the eyes open, and take in the space in the room. So if you're at home, this will work fine. Wherever you are, there's space. Let your gaze be wide and tall, both directions. So we've got a big open gaze, and be aware of space. Just sort of relax with space of this room you're in. The eyes are soft, but focused. The gaze is wide and big, aware of space. Okay, just a little bit. Anyone care to share a word? How does that affect you? Just a word to name how you are right now. I'll just throw out the word calm.
Peaceful.
Pardon?
Peaceful.
Peaceful. Calm, peaceful, open. In just a little bit of space awareness, notice what happens. We're so addicted to objects that have intensity, you know. We want the pleasant first, but we'll take the unpleasant. We rarely notice the neutral. But what's amazing about the neutral is it's the doorway into being and ease and relaxation. If we can do it, the mind often just goes away. But if we can just gently, patiently keep coming back and notice neutral, notice space. Like, what's more neutral than space, right? But the effect on us can be very like calming and easing and peacemaking, as you all said, opening. So our intellectual mind wants pleasant and then unpleasant. But our contemplative heart really appreciates neutral because it's the gateway to being. If we can stay with neutral, we start to really be. So it's very important to notice neutral. And that's why generally, you know, we recommend something neutral like the breath as our object for practice. Because actually we slowly, it's like it people whispers us into being, into just presence. So that's how we work with neutral. The way to work with neutral is to just start noticing it. Because it's everywhere. We always want foreground. And there's a reason for that. So this, it's not pathological. There's a reason for it, right? It helped us survive millions of years ago. But it's not necessary anymore. We can just start looking around and noticing neutral. If our reactive relationship with neutral is delusion or ignorance, then the minute we're mindful of neutral, we're out of reaction, meaning we're connected with what is. So